seconds after you're done. How's that?
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to welcome everybody to another season of Family Beit Midrash. I want to speak a little about the shul, and then we're going to pass it along and have a series of introductions, but we're really thrilled to have this program here. It's one of the integral programs that we have here in the synagogue, and on Sunday nights, children and families and adults from different ages and different backgrounds can come together in a real evening of Torah study on a very serious level. And you'll be hearing more about our speaker this evening to launch the particular program this year. We're very excited. Hopefully everybody had V'achalta V'savata, and hopefully V'erachta also. And hopefully the... don't want to start after Yantiv, you know, but the Savata, we should feel satisfied with learning as well. We should make sure that our lips are wet with Torah study as well. So in addition to Family Beit Midrash, which we're honored to host here, and thanks to the Orbach family for so many years have been having this wonderful program here, and it's so really heartwarming to see such a large crowd in the evening, and it should continue through all of other shiurim, which I know Gil and his group and Michael have planned very hard, all kinds of particular programs. We just came off of Simchas Torah, where the children got up here and gave Divrei Torah and got lollipops, and it's really a very fun place. We have a class that's going to be starting next Tuesday in the laws of Shabbos, be very hands-on. Obviously, knowing the laws of Shabbos is very important. It's every seventh day, you need to do so for 25 hours. And one of the hardest parts of keeping Shabbos is that you can't call me, and I can't call my rabbis. So we're all stuck knowing and we really need to know the laws. And since we're all keeping Shabbos, it's very important, and we would welcome everybody to come. There are no costs, of course, Tuesday nights. Wednesday night, I believe, Rabbi Wolf, I think it's Wednesday nights, he has his class on Sefer HaChinuch. You don't want to miss this class. He goes through a different halacha, different mitzvah in the Torah every night, and he goes through in the Sefer HaChinuch's way, the rationales and the applications, and it's really something that's a very popular class here, and we hope that you can come. Shabbos, we have learning as well. I give a class, I'm going to start a class actually, after davening, about 25 minutes into Kiddush, we're going to start a class on davening actually. We're going to go through different tefillot every week, be about 5 to 10 minutes every week, so nobody's being kept from their meals. And then in the afternoon we have a class on the Rambam, on the underpinnings of what it means to believe as a Jew. And Sunday mornings we have a class on Tehillim, going through the Book of Psalms, and looking at it both as a historical, what King David was thinking, what he was experiencing when he wrote a specific chapter, and of course looking at the beautiful words, many of which are tefillot. So we hope that Family Beit Midrash will be one of many portals that many of you will have into our shul, which hopefully is contributing to the great mosaic that we have here in Stanford, and in the growth that we're seeing in the community. So I look forward to joining you, and look forward to learning from Rabbi Feiner. I'd like to turn over to Michael Feinstein.
Thank you, Rabbi Krimsky. Gil just mentioned that he's passing along a sheet that you can sign in and give some contact information to make sure that you're made aware of future programs. So please sign in when the paper and pen come around. Thank you all for attending this inaugural session of the Family Beit Midrash program, graciously sponsored again by the Orbach family. We have a very rich programming year ahead, and we hope you'll be attending our programs regularly. And this evening, we're hosting Rabbi Eitan Feiner. He's a rising star in the Orthodox Jewish world, and his topic will attempt to answer the following question. Is vegetarianism the Torah ideal? And we do hope that all of the meat that you have in your freezer will not go to waste after hearing tonight's shiur. I already thank Janet Bein and Sharon Shavrick. Thank you for putting together that great dinner for us. And without further ado, I just want to give Rabbi Feiner his proper introduction. Rabbi Feiner is currently the spiritual leader of Knesset Israel in Barakaway, which is known as the White Shul. He learned at Ne'er Israel Rabbinical College. He received his smicha from Zalman Nechemia Goldberg in Israel. He also has a master's degree from Johns Hopkins University, and he was a Magichir at Eish HaTorah. He often speaks at Gateways programs, actually right in Stanford, so he does know his way around the community. He is a noted scholar. He's a sought-after lecturer. One interesting fact that a lot of people probably don't know about Rabbi Feiner is when he was younger, he wanted to play football and be the starting quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys. And given the Cowboys' 1-2 record right now, you may want to suit up next week.
Just recently become a Jets fan.
That's a good move. Also, many of you may be familiar with Rabbi Feiner's sister, Shani Tarragon, who has lectured in Stanford many times. And, you know, the high level of scholarship that each of them possess can only reinforce the belief that there's probably a genetic component to accumulating Torah knowledge. Although I would also argue that their talents are equally a reflection of their parents, encouraging them to study Torah and to share its wisdom with others. And we're very grateful to be hosting such a talented young star. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Rabbi Eitan Feiner.
My sister usually says that I told her everything she knows. I'll tell you, she told me everything I know. Baruch Hashem, we get along great. I know she's been out to Stanford. It's indeed a tremendous honor and a privilege to be out here as well, not to have to be working overtime, 3-4 lectures a day at the Hilton on a Gateways program. I get to relax. I get to enjoy. Everyone here is relaxing. Had a great Indian dinner. I hope you ate all the meat and all the flakes you want, because you might not be eating it anymore for the rest of your lives. But I have to say, after coming tonight and hearing Rabbi Krimsky, hearing the lineup of all these fantastic shiurim going on, I'm thinking, I've only been by the line for 2.5 years. I'm thinking, right now, I'm going to line up a sabbatical this coming year. I'm going to take off, move to Stanford. I got these great classes going on.
You're welcome.
So it's really a pleasure. I want to thank Rabbi Krimsky, of course. I want to thank special Hakor Satov, an overwhelming sense of gratitude to Michael Feldstein, for calling me up, for putting this all together, for Rabbi Krimsky welcoming me into his shul. It's a tremendous honor and a privilege to be here this evening to speak about vegetarianism. Certainly eating is always at the forefront of our minds. In fact, we just heard the idea of Yachalta v'Savalta v'Ra'alta. The rabbi got up and he said that you have to eat, you have to be satisfied. The verse tells us in Parshas Eker, and then you have to conclude, it has to culminate with a blessing, with the grace after meals, with Birkat HaMazon. So parenthetically, it reminds me, I saw once in a little kutras, in a little sefer, in a little book, it's called Watching Your Weight, the Torah Way. And it's by this Rabbi Goldberger from Staten Island, and he starts on page 1, a true story, that there was a yeshiva bacha, there was a boy learning in yeshiva, and all of a sudden one morning he wakes up and he has this insatiable appetite. Out of the blue, just hit him out of nowhere, and it's binge eating, and he goes into his fridge, and it's one pint of ice cream, another pint of ice cream, and he can't hold back, he can't surmount this obstacle, he's got this unquenchable thirst, insatiable appetite, and he's eating, and doesn't know what to do, and he runs from doctor to doctor to doctor, and it's all fruitless, no one has any suggestion, nothing's helping, no panacea in sight. He doesn't know what to do. He's an average weight, and all of a sudden he's putting on the pounds, becoming more and more obese day by day. And so finally he goes to a big tzaddik, and this righteous person says, you know what, check your mezuzahs. What about whenever things are happening in your life, go and check the mezuzahs. True story. So the guy takes the mezuzah in front of his house off the door, and he brings it to the sofer, to the scribe to check. And sure enough, the verse reads, V'achalta v'savata v'ra'alta v'nasata isa v'sovcha. And then the verse reads, after you'll have all the fruit and all the food, then V'achalta v'savata v'ra'alta. The scribe accidentally wrote, V'achalta v'achalta. No V'achalta v'savata, no eating and being satisfied. He wrote V'achalta, you'll eat, V'achalta, and you'll eat a little bit more. He changed it, and boom, the next morning, that's it, it went away, everything was good. Gotta check those mezuzahs. So we eat, we get satisfied, we give a blessing. But what can we eat? Should we espouse a vegetarian lifestyle? It's a fascinating book out there. I don't know if you're familiar with the producers from Britain, they penned a number of works, John Lloyd and John Mitchinson. They produced a TV show called QI, and they've written the book of General Ignorance, the book of Animal Ignorance, New York Times bestsellers, and the latest book, I just love it, I had a mind for the title. If ignorance is bliss, why aren't there so many more happy people? So on page 331 of the book, we find fascinating quotes about vegetarianism, beginning with George Bernard Shaw, who says that, you know, I am a vegetarian. He says, how can I take a mind as brilliant as mine? That's what he says about himself. I guess he wasn't the most humble of men, but he says, how can I take a brilliant mind and feed it and nourish it with cow meat? How can I do such a thing? Okay? Everyone's entitled to his or her own opinion. Reader Under, the famous comedian, said, I used to be a vegetarian until, after all the fruits and vegetables, I started finding myself always leaning towards the sunlight. So she had to give it up. So what's the story? Should we be vegetarians? Is it kosher? Is it not kosher? How should we lead our lives? Well, first we have to know the facts. So let's have a cursory glance at some of the facts. We have to go back 32 years. Let's go to a famous article in the New York Times, 1978. At that time, they reported there were already 35 restaurants in New York City alone, catering towards an excess of 100,000 vegetarians living in just New York City alone. And at that time, there were already more than 10 million vegetarians in the world. 1978, and the number has been rising exponentially ever since. To the extent that if I take you to the VRG, the Vegetarian Resource Group, they were polled, they're the ones who the New York Times really based the article upon, but in 2000 there was a national Zogby poll, and it was reported that 14% of Catholics are vegetarians, 15% of Protestants, and 14% of Jews are actually vegetarians. Now, of course, there are various gradations of veggies. There are even 26% of those who responded said they don't even eat honey. Even honey produced by bees, they're going to abstain from. So again, there are always different levels, different madrigas, different gradations, how one decides to espouse a vegetarian lifestyle. But 6% of those between the ages of 18 and 29 said that they were vegetarian. More than double were women. More than double were women. People decide, especially women, let's go and be vegetarians. Now, why would you think a person would want to be a vegetarian? After all, you ever have a piece of filet mignon, a piece of prime rib, a succulent prime rib, and a chasen at a Jewish wedding? Who wouldn't want to enjoy it? So why would a person want to be vegetarian? So let's go quickly through the various responses based on this 2000 Zogby poll. It was repeated again in 2004. At that time, it was recorded that there were 4.8 million non-institutionalized vegetarians in the United States alone. Again, you can always understand what does it mean, non-institutionalized. Okay. 82% said the reason they abstain from meat and all byproducts of meat is because, take a guess.
It's gross.
Well, it's gross. That would be the taste. That would be the taste. Let's say 31% said they decided to espouse a vegetarian lifestyle because they just didn't like it. They didn't like the taste of meat, the veal, etc. 31% responded. 26% said economic reasons. It's a lot more expensive to go out to a meat, to a flagship restaurant. You want to take your wife on the anniversary. Right? What happens? It comes the anniversary. You want to take your wife out. Right? What's the best way, by the way, to remember the anniversary? Forget it once. So you take your wife out on her anniversary. You take your spouse out to eat. You know, you could save a lot of money by going to a dairy restaurant instead of a meat restaurant. So 26% of those who responded said that they espouse a vegetarian lifestyle for purely pragmatic, practical concerns. We have taste, we have economics, but 82% said because of health reasons. Whether it's the enzymes, the insecticides, the mad cow disease, whether it's all the cholesterol, whether it's the obesity, health concerns, you put it all together under the rubric called health, and that's the largest percentage of those who decided to espouse a vegetarian lifestyle, 82%. 75% based it on environmental concerns, but, and it's going to be a little difficult for us to discern between the two, as you'll see as we go onwards in the lecture. But at this point in time, for the purpose of the study, they encompassed the following in one category that 75% of the respondents said this is the primary reason, a paramount concern to them was what? Was environmental, moral, and religious grounds. I don't like the way that they treat animals. How can you treat animals in such a fashion? I don't like this putting them and sequestering them and confining them into these small cubicles, and the way that you treat them. And anyone knows Temple Grandin, they've already made movies about her. She's written bestsellers, 2005, New York Times bestseller, Animals in Translation. We know Masson and McCarthy, going back to 1998, their New York Times bestseller, When Elephants Weep, The Emotional Lives of Animals. Yes, they have emotions, and everyone agrees that they have emotions. They have emotions, they have feelings. The Rabbi Maimonides, already way back in the 1000s, Maimonides tells us, in his Guide to the Perplexed, the Moreh Nevuchim, in Chelek Gimel, in section 3, in chapter 48, he outlines that a number of the prohibitions in the Torah are predicated on this very concept, that a mother cow cares for its baby. Shiluach HaKein, writes Maimonides. There's a commandment in Parshas Ki Tzeitzei in Deuteronomy, and 22, verse 6, the famous machlokas dispute between Maimonides and Achmonides. One of the reasons why we send away the motherboard, if you want to make scrambled eggs for breakfast in the morning, and you want to take the fledglings, you want to take the eggs, and you want to make scrambled eggs, the Torah commands and obligates you, you got to send away the motherboard first. Why? Again, writes Maimonides there in 348 in his Guide to the Perplexed, because we're concerned about the feelings of animals. And yes, they have feelings. Now, the truth is, as Rabbi Chaim Baruch Stern writes in the Sefer Nishmas Kochai, and in his Kuntos Otzer Yedias, there is a concept, and even if you read Masson and McCarthy, Emotional Lives of Animals When Elephants Weep, and you read all the scholarly works on the subject in Old Temple Grandin, yes, there is a filial bond, there's a family relationship, but it only extends thus far, vis-a-vis the mother and the child, a parent and a child. There's no concept, this is a parenthetical point, but it's a fascinating phenomenon. There's no concept of grandchildren when it comes to animals. They might care about their own descendants, about their own children, but there's nothing like an anicle. There's not like grandmother wants to take the anicle, you want to take your grandchild on the lap, right? And we know that parents get a greater appreciation of their own children when they see their own children through the eyes of their parents, of the grandparents. There's no concept of grandparents when it comes to animals, only when it comes to human beings. That's why the strongest manifestation of closeness, of a bond in this world, is represented by an Evan, by a stone. And Rashi writes in Parshas Vayechi in chapter 49, Evan is really a conjugation of the two Hebrew words, Av and Ben. Av and Ben, which is a father and a son, form this unique, strong, this mighty filial connection called an Evan, a stone connection. Evan is a conjugation of Av and Ben. When the two merge, when they fuse, the synthesis, the upshot is an Evan. But many Sfarim, many books write that it's also Rosh Tavis, an acronym, Av Ben Anecha. A father, a son, and a grandchild. That's an Evan. That's a close human relationship. Animals don't have such a concept. In fact, you know why in Yiddish, why we call grandchildren an Enochel? And we're wondering in Yiddish to call them an Enochel. You know why? If I could take you back to the momentous encounter of Moshe Rabbeinu, of Moses by the burning bush. Segal says in the pages, the sacred pages of his Torah, that the bush was on fire, was boer ba'esh, it was being consumed by fire, but what? Hasnei neruka. It was not being consumed. And miraculously, yes, it was on fire, but it was not being consumed. Enenuka means it continues to be perpetuated throughout time. You know what an enenukal is? When you have a child and then you have a grandchild, through that scion, through that descendant, through that grandchild, now your legacy is going to be perpetuated through time. It will be a perennial memory and remembrance. Enenukal, enenukal in Yiddish, comes from enenuka. You're never going to be destroyed. You're never going to be consumed. You're going to go on forever. Animals don't have the relationship, but yes, they have feelings. So if somebody says, I can't believe it, I'm going to take away an animal and I'm going to kill it, I'm going to slaughter it in front of its mother, how can you do that? 75% environmental concerns, religious, moral, and ethical grounds, I want to be a vegetarian. So just a quick recap, what do we have? 82% health reasons. 75% based their response on environmental, moral, and religious grounds. Ethical concerns, 26%. Economics, 31% taste, they don't like it. All the reasons why a person might want to be a Jew, it wasn't included in the poll. But we have fascinating Gemara in the Babylonian Talmud, in Tractate Pesachim in 49b, that says that an Am HaOretz, an ignoramus, is not allowed to consume meat. Why? Explains the Marshal and other commentaries, because they don't know how to keep a kosher kitchen. Gets very complicated. If a person's only going to be limited, your dietary intake, your culinary delights will be restricted to purely a vegetative, vegetarian type of lifestyle, then you don't have to worry. It's not too difficult to keep a kosher kitchen. But if you don't know all the intricate, the myriad laws of how to separate between meat and milk, etc., it becomes very difficult. In fact, my wife says her number one weakness in the world, besides me, of course, her number one weakness is chocolate. Chocolate, right? What's a healthy, what's it's a good balanced diet. Chocolate in the right hand and chocolate in the left hand. It's a nice, well balanced diet. So it's an amazing thing. My wife always points out, you can have people who are addicted to chocolate. I mean, if you're going to be addicted to something, let it at least be chocolate. Says that you can be addicted to chocolate, but yet what? The religious and observant Jew, when you eat the fleshic meal, you have a nice Indian cuisine, and all of a sudden the Torah says you got to wait, depending on your custom, whether it's 1 hour the Zohar, whether it's 3 hours you come from the Dutch, you're yucky, whether you wait 6 hours or into the 6 hour, also an halacha comes that says, amen, now you can abstain from chocolate. During the week, forget about it. Chocolate for breakfast, chocolate for lunch, for dinner, but all of a sudden you eat meat. Oh no, I got to wait an hour, I got to wait 3 hours, I got to wait. Halacha controls us. So let's say there's a person that says, you know what, I'm working on my spirituality, continuous ascent. I want to always attain loftier and loftier spiritual plateaus. So I want to abstain something, I want to give up. Sacrifice, life is all about sacrifice. So you want to give up something. So a person for Inyani Precious, if you want to abstain from something in the world, even though of course Judaism accounts for distinction to so many other religions in the world, we do not at all espouse an ascetic lifestyle. You read Hermann Hesse's Siddhartha, famous book, The Boy is Searching, What's the True Religion? Yiddishkeit Judaism does not at all advocate. We don't champion an ascetic lifestyle. We believe you go in to get married and you have children, and God wants you to enjoy His world. He wants you to go and enjoy the world, but a person could say, you know what? I'm going to enjoy the world, but I got to cut back somewhere. Something, I got to make some cuts, some demonstration, that I don't just eat everything I want. So yes, the laws of kashrus. Yes, the very fact you go on vacation. I don't know about you. I love to travel. I've been to Europe. I've been to, thank God, a number of different places. And I find that the one constant reminder that no matter where we go, we're always Jewish. You can't just eat in every restaurant. You know, one of the big sales when you go to these travel agencies, you go, you can eat this place for breakfast and this place for lunch and this place for dinner. But a Jew, that's it. You can put on the jeans and t-shirt and the baseball cap and you think no one's going to recognize you. Forget about it. In fact, I remember I was in Rome touring. The first time I went to Rome with my wife. So we're walking in the streets of Rome, and this is the beginning of the Intifada, and there was some anti-Semitism already in the ambiance. It was tangible, the anti-Semitism in Europe. This goes back a number of years now. Of course, terror alerts now coming. Don't travel to Europe. So my wife and I were walking in the streets of Rome, and we're heading towards the Colosseum and to the Forum. And my wife says, Eitan, you know, I think you look, you stand out a little too much. You stand out a little too much. I said, no problem. I said, I'll get a baseball cap. She always wondered, who are those nerds who buy those Italy caps for $5? Like, you know, why didn't I just come with my Dallas Cowboys, which is now a Jets cap? And I wondered, why didn't I just come with the baseball cap, with the football cap? And I'm one of those guys, okay, so I spent the $5, $6. That's what the caps are there for, by the way. All the people who forgot to pack their baseball caps, they're the ones who buy these Italy caps. So I put on the Italy cap. Well, I says, come on, Eitan, what do you think? You don't look Jewish, right? We all know the famous story. The guy, he's there with the jeans, the sneakers, the baseball cap, walking in the airport, and the violin player who's playing Billy Joel, all of a sudden this guy walks by, Hava, Nagila, Hava, right? That's it. You could tell a Jew from a mile away. So my wife says, forget it. You could wear the baseball cap, you could tuck in your tzitzis, you're still going to stand out. There's no way to... I said, what do you mean? I'm not going to stand out. I put on the baseball cap. I took in my tzitzis. I don't want any anti-Semitic instances. And so, you know, better to play it safe. We're walking towards the Colosseum. And as we get to the Colosseum, all of a sudden I hear, Yehudi, Yehudi! And it's an Israeli guy selling postcards outside the Roman Colosseum. And he saw me from 3 miles away. Yehudi, a Jew, a Jew. I said, you see, Aviva, forget the baseball cap, forget it. No, you got to keep it on. And no, we're going to go into the Forum now after the Colosseum. You got to go. I said, no, I don't know. You know, maybe I should just, should I keep it on? We're going back and forth, we're vacillating. Should we not? As we're finishing the discussion, believe it or not, I'm not exaggerating, 70 rabbis come out of the Forum. The 3 days we happened to be in Rome, there was a rabbinic convention of all European rabbis, and they happened to be coming out. I take the baseball cap off, and it's just like a put back. Yeah, 70 rabbis, I'll just join the group. And little did we know, the one kosher restaurant, Yovant, in the middle of Rome, we said, oh, they told us when we were traveling, you don't have to make a reservation. That never fills up. How many religious Jews care to eat in a kosher restaurant in the middle of Rome? But the 3 days were there. 70 European rabbis. I had to wait 4 hours to have dinner that night. So let's say somebody says, I want to separate a little bit from this world. So that's another reason a person might want to champion a vegetarian lifestyle. I don't want to get too much unknown, too much pleasure from this world. Now, what is the true Jewish hashgacha? The famous Katzke Rebbe used to say, Anshe Kodesh Tiyuli, the verse reads, Hashem says, I don't want you to be like malachim. I don't want you to be angels. Angels don't have any necessity to eat. God doesn't want us to be fasting all the time. Yes, there's a time, Yom Kippur, Tisha B'av, there are days to fast. But he wants us to be part of this world, to engage his world in the philosophy, the wonders, astonishing, incredible things in this universe, and he wants us to enjoy them. But you always have to make barriers. You have to cut certain things off. Certain things should be off limits. If a person says, you know what, I don't want to enjoy the world too much, so maybe I'll abstain a little bit. You know what, I won't have 3 scoops of ice cream, I'll only have 2. I'll have the 2, I won't have the hot chocolate fudge and the butterscotch fudge and the toppings, etc. It's always good to make cuts. The Vilna Gaon, the famous Rabbi Eliel Kramer, the sage from Vilna, 1720, 1798, he talks about it in his letter, Olam the Truth, for the famous Igeres HaGra, as well as really Rishonim, the medieval commentators. The Rife, it brings in his introduction to his famous work, the Bali Anefesh, he quotes a Rabbeinu Yonah. Rabbeinu Yonah writes that a person should cut off, leave a little bit over in a plate. God says, don't stop eating pizza, don't stop eating steak, don't stop eating chocolate, just, you don't have to finish everything on your plate. So the next time your kids say, Ma, I don't want any more Brussels sprouts. Yeah, they could say, Rabbeinu Yonah, I've got Rabbeinu Yonah and the Rife and the Vilna Gaon on my side. You don't have to finish everything on the plate, but it doesn't mean stay away from it. Doesn't mean stay away from it, like the Kutzgrabber says, Anshe Kodesh, I want you to be holy, but first and foremost, I want you to be human. I want you to be human people who are holy. That's what I want you to be. So, for example, person says, I like Häagen-Dazs ice cream, I like Carvel, I like Chalav Yisrael Kleins, so I'm going to come back. It doesn't mean I'm not going to eat ice cream ever again. It means I don't have to have all the scoops, I don't have to have all the trimmings, I don't have to have all the toppings. When you go to the wedding and they serve you the succulent prime rib and the portobello mushrooms and the basting with this fantastic gravy sauce, you don't have to finish every last bite. But to say I'm not going to be a part of this world, to say I'm going to abstain from meat because I don't want to enjoy God's world at all, that's incorrect. Let's go back to the Torah reading of yesterday. Let's go back to this past week's parasha, the first book. In Genesis, let's go to the story of the beginning, Bereishis, the beginning. I'm talking about the Yankees, yes, hopefully they'll win the pennant. But the beginning, let's go to the beginning. So we go to the beginning of it all. Let me ask you a question. How many commandments were Adam and Eve given in the Garden of Eden? I've thrown out this question a bunch of times. Very few people get it. How many commandments were they given? One? Who said two? What was the second one? Okay, that's one command. One command is in chapter 2 and verse 17, don't eat from the Eitz Hadas Tovah, don't partake from the tree of knowledge. What's the other one? Peruvu. Excellent. Okay, but before Peruvu, I'm sorry, so let me be a little more specific. When they were first placed into Gan Eden, what were the? How many commandments were they given right at the outset? Peruvu came later. How many were they given right at the outset? What was the second one? Okay, so naming the animals wasn't an actual commandment. It does appear, you're right, in chapter 2 in verses 19 and 20. There Adam does name the animals, but the command is based on the Radat, yes?
To control the animal.
Do the animal. Etc. Again, that's not that's a display, that's an expression of the control, the sovereignty that man will be expressing throughout the course of his lifetime, but it wasn't a specific mitzvah taseh. I'll share with you a Radat, Rav David Kimchi, and the Rabbeinu Bechai, these are Gedolim Rishonim, some of the greatest, foremost medieval commentaries on the Torah, as well as Rav Meir Simcha HaKohen from the Vitz, and his unbelievable commentary called the Meshech Chochma, all commenting on Bereishis, on the book of Genesis, chapter 2 and verse 16. Everybody knows Adam and Eve are placed into the Garden of Eden. I don't want you to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. There was one command that preceded that. Excellent. Beautiful. Mikol Eitz Hagan Achol Tochel. The first commander given, writes the Radak, writes Rabbeinu Bechai, writes the Meshech Chochma, is Mikol Eitz Hagan Achol Tochel. Before he commands them, before they're enjoined from partaking, from consuming of the tree of knowledge, he issues an explicit command. I want you to go out into my beautiful, lustrous garden, and I want you to partake of all the trees. Type of a mitzvah saseh is this? The Rishonim actually call it a mitzvah saseh, and the Zohar makes it clear because they were placed in the garden, the Avdu L'Shamra, to keep it, to protect it. Writes the Zohar, they were given mitzvot saseh and mitzvot lo taseh. Positive and negative. Where was the positive commandment? Yes, there's a concept of puravu, etc. But what were they given right then? The first command that they were given was what? I want you to eat from all the trees. What in the world is that all about? Writes Rav Meir Simcha from the Vitz. This is the source of an esoteric comment by Rabbi Eliezer. And the Rishalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, Tractate Kedushin of chapter 4 in Halacha 12. Amo Rav Elozer, the Rishalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud states, the Rav Elozer opines that Osir in the future
Yitain din v'cheshbon al koma she'in avro v'lo nenem imedem. We're going to have to give a judgment, a din v'cheshbon, a calculation in front of the heavenly tribunal, in front of God, why we saw things in this beautiful world and we did not partake of them. God says, I gave you pizza. I gave you ice cream. I gave you filet mignon and prime rib, and I gave you portobello mushrooms and mashed potatoes. I gave you Indian cuisine in Stamford, Connecticut. Whoever would have thought? I gave you all these things. So you say, no, that's it. No, I'm working on myself spiritually. No Indian cuisine for me, at least for the next 3 minutes. Right? That person says, I'm going to abstain. I'm going to hold back. No Indian cuisine. Is that what God wants? Did you show me the Jerusalem Talmud says? You're going to have to give a din l'cheshbon. You're going to have to answer in front of God in this heavenly tribunal. If God gave it to this world, He wants you to partake of it. So if a person to say, I don't want to eat meat because I have to abstain, it's too much pleasure in this world, it's getting too much benefit, that's not the Jewish hashkafa, that's not the Jewish philosophy. It means that yes, I'm supposed to enjoy it. If God gave it to us, He wants us to enjoy it, but it means don't overdo it. Don't overdo it. Everything has to be with limitations, with restrictions, the right time, the right place, in the right measure. It has to be the right amount. Can be. That's why we have so many laws. We have laws of conscience. There are certain things that are simply off limits. And you can see Rav Samson of Paul Hirsch has a beautiful exposition about this in his essay in Chorev, the famous word Chorev in chapter 68. Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman, his introductory work to his Perush al HaTorah and Sefer Vayikra, and numerous others as well, about the Torah Hashkafa. The Torah philosophy is be involved in my world. Be engaged in my world. Eat it. Partake of its worldly, the mundane delights. But do everything in the right time, in the right place, in the right measure. Don't overdo it, and everything's going to be great. So, based on that alone, we would say, yes, let's go ahead and eat meat. Everything in the right time, in the right place. And we'll discuss that towards the end of the lecture tonight. What is the right time and the right place? But either way, we have a number of reasons why a person might decide to adopt a vegetarian lifestyle. So let's go back. Before we can really tackle the fundamentals, we have to go back to the beginning of time. And we have to understand what is the ideal? What is utopia vis-a-vis meat consumption? So let me ask you a question. We have a lot of blessings. We make a bore mine mazonot. We make a bore priya eitz, a bore adola, a whole list of blessings. We have a whole chapter in the sixth chapter of the Babylonian Talmud and Tractate Brachot, beginning with 35a. We have so many laws, intricate, myriad detailed laws, all about the various blessings, the manifold blessings that we recite in respect to foods. Is there a special blessing when you eat meat? Why not? Isn't meat something special? When you sit down, there's a big difference between just having a side order of French fries, but if you have a nice beef burger, if you have a nice pastrami and turkey sandwich, why wouldn't it? Writes Rabbi David Avudram, one of the Rishonim, one of the medieval commentators. He says it's so chashuv, it's so important. Something like meat, we know, really is in a category all by itself, and really it warrants its own specific blessing. So you know why Chazal, you know why sages did not issue and establish a specific blessing for meat? Because the blessing would have been Borei Chayos Haaretz. Hashem created the Chayos, the animals of the world, and we should have recited such a blessing before consuming meat. And you know why we don't? Because it's not the ideal. Because the ideal is not to be consuming meat. How do you like that? It's not the ideal. How do we know it's not the ideal? To the extent that Rav Kook, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, he has a two-volume work in his commentary on the Siddur, on the prayer book, and volume one of his commentary, page 292, he writes that in the future, believe it or not, we will not have karbonot. We will not have sacrifices. We're going to offer on the altar sacrifices, but only of plants, fruits, and vegetables. We're not going to have meat sacrifices. This is a novel concept. Where is he getting this from? Where is the Avodah Zarah coming from? Where is he? He's coming out of left field to go in and say that we would have recited a unique blessing to meat. And the reason we don't is because it's not utopia. It's not. How do you know that? Well, don't we have to rewind to utopia? Let's go back to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And let's see, what is the ideal? Obviously, they were made in the ideal, right? Just like they had the ideal marriage, right? Adam didn't have to hear about all the men that Eve could have dated. And Eve didn't have to hear about how well Adam's mother cooked. Right? So they had the ideal marriage. Even though every time Adam came home from work, of course Eve went and checked how many ribs he had left. But okay, we know they had the ideal marriage. This is utopia. This is the best marriage in the world. This is the best setting. There's nobody else, and no other woman around, no other men around. It's just Adam and Eve. This is utopia. We got the garden of paradise. We have a special command: go out into my garden and enjoy it and derive pleasure. Get all the benefits you can. Let me ask you a question. In the Garden of Eden, were Adam and Eve allowed to eat meat?
No.
How do you know that?
After Noah.
Excellent.
Okay,
well, she's quoting, she's really quoting an exact verse already. She's already holding by Parsha Noah in chapter 9 and verse 3, where Noah is given the command, Lachem liyelachlo, where he is told specifically that he and his family can go out and eat meat. From that we deduce that it must be that until Noah was granted the license, until he was given the green light, Adam and Eve were not allowed to partake of meat. Is that the general consensus? Not necessarily. It's the machlokus, it's a dispute amongst the foremost medieval commentators. According to Ramban, according to Nachmanides in his commentary on the book of Genesis in chapter 1, verse 29, yes, the Ramban opines that they were never allowed to consume meat, whether they would kill the animal for the purpose of its meat, or even if the animal would die on its own. They were never allowed to eat meat. That's the opinion of the Ramban. Another Rishonim jump on his bandwagon. However, Rashi's mashmaot, the superficial inference inferred from Rashi, is that it's only if they would kill an animal, that's what they were enjoined from doing. But if the animal died on its own, they were allowed to eat the meat. And even though Rashi doesn't state it explicitly in his commentary on the Torah, he has a commentary on the Babylonian Talmud, if I could take it to Tractate Sanhedrin, to page 57a, Rashi there writes it explicitly, as do the Bali Atosis. If I could flip back one page, let's rewind to 56b. The Bali Atosis also stated explicitly, Rashi and Tosis 56b, 57a, that he writes clearly that it was only when an animal died on its own they were allowed to eat the meat. They weren't allowed to kill an animal for the sake of its meat. But if an animal died, and something Rav Heschel discusses in the Chanukah Satorah, how is it possible animals would die? They wouldn't even die until after the sin. So that's a major discussion. But you have your dispute amongst the Rishonim. Some of the foremost commentators actually posit that if an animal died on its own, they were allowed to eat its meat. They were just forbidden from killing an animal for the sake of its meat. Here we have a dispute. See, here at least there's a Pesach. There's an entrance to say that maybe we were allowed even from the outset to consume meat. But you could hear where Rav Kook with the Abu Jerama coming from, that at least according to Nachmanides' opinion, they were never allowed to eat meat. And since that represents the ideal, Adam and Eve, of course, this is utopia, so that must be what the ideal is. It's just that what's something changed? Well, we had some major changes going on in the Garden of Eden. First thing we had, a sin of Adam and Eve. Now before the sin, how would we characterize the animals in the Garden of Eden? We know there are a lot of animals, snakes, famous guys. We know that Adam named them all. That's what we read in Genesis in chapter 2 and verses 19 and 20. We know that he named the domesticated, the chayes, he named everything. Oh, by the way, he never named the fish. You know, fish are not mentioned anywhere, by the way. If you look at verses 19 and 20, it talks about the hamos, talks about the chayos, the ophos, the birds. He never named the fish. So the Radak and the Chaskuni, some commentaries say, well, what are you going to do? Fish can't come out of the water. If they come out of the water, they're going to die. Well, come on, God's doing the miracles. So he can do whatever he wants. No fish were named, and thus if you take a journey throughout all of Tanakh, throughout the whole biblical canon, throughout all the scriptures, you'll never encounter once the name of any fish. These poor fish. None of them have any names. Even the one that swallowed up Yonah, it's called the dog. The dog Agadol, it's called the generic fish. This is all fascinating discussion on that, but you'll have to bring me back here. Tell me next time you have the Indian cuisine. And next time it might have to be pizza. After this year, it might just have to be pizza and falafel. I don't know. But the fish were never named. You'll never find them any. We only have a relation. When was the last time, you know, people named their pet turtles, their cats, their dogs? People named their goldfish, right? Some people do, but, you know, you don't really have a relationship. You don't talk to fish. They're only creatures, by the way, is the Maral. From Prague talks in chapter 39 of his work, Netzach Yisrael, Chelek Gimel, volume 3 of his Chiddush HaGadlus. Fish are the only creatures in the world that don't communicate via sound. Only creatures, yes, dolphins, whales, those are mammals, not fish. Only creatures in the world that don't communicate by sound. Interesting, God always works measure for measure. What was the problem of Jonah? We're talking about the story of Jonah. Jonah didn't open up his mouth when he was supposed to. He's the paradigmatic example, if I could take you to Sanhedrin 69a, of someone who suppressed his prophetic vision. If God gives you a prophecy, you're obligated or obliged to reveal it, to express it to the world. He kept his mouth shut, measure for measure. What did God do? He got swallowed up by a whale. He got swallowed up by a big fish. It's called the Daga Gadol. That doesn't speak. The fish don't communicate via sound. They're the only ones who don't speak, but that's a separate discussion. They're the only creatures, by the way, they never stop swimming throughout their entire lifetime. unbelievable discussion. We'll talk about that. That's David Feldman, Lifes and Parables, pages 442. It's Richard Ellis, the Encyclopedia of Sea, page 308. There's a lot to talk about how fish never stop swimming. A tuna fish can swim 15 miles an hour in its lifetime in excess of 1 million miles. These guys never stop swimming. Creatures never stop swimming. What's it all about? Oh, by the way, did they go fishing on Noah's Ark? I'm sure you always write, your kids must have wondered about it. Did they go fishing on Noah's Ark? How could they go fishing? They only had two worms. It's not my joke. It's not my joke. And even if it is, if it doesn't go over so well, it's certainly not my joke. So we have Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. So we have all these opinions, what the precise nature of the animals. Now, there's a fascinating Rashi. If I take it now to chapter 2, verse 23, Adam has brought Eve. He sees all the animals of the world and he intellectually decides that they're just not for him. So finally, Eve is brought to Adam and he says, Zosapam, now's the time. Etzemeat, Samashi, that she's part and parcel of who I am, who really one androgynous being. It's a discussion, in fact, in the Babylonian Talmud in two places, in Tractate Brachot 61a and Tractate Ketuvot on 8a. According to many opinions, they were created as Zohar and Keva Baral, male and female, one androgynous being, and then they were subsequently divided into two. To highlight, as the Vilna Gaon, Rav Yitzchak Hazachover, many commentaries explain, as opposed to all the animals in the world that came into the world, Zohar and Keva as two mutually exclusive beings, two separate entities, male and female, Adam and Eve came down as one being to show that marriage is all about becoming one, is merging and fusing into that one individual, just like you have one neshama, v'hayu l'basar echad, marital relations, you make yourself into one guf, as a physical echo of what's taking place in the loftier spiritual plane, that the two chilkei ha-neshama, the two sides of the same coin, the two halves of the same soul, are really fusing, merging into one. That's Adam and Eve, they're one neshama. So he's looking for that partner, he's looking for that soulmate. Rashi tells us, based on the Gemara, the Babylonian narrative, in Babylonian Talmud, in Tractate Yevamot, in the bottom of 63a, that Adam was ba' akol behemah v'behemah v'lo niskara daito chabalcha. If you take this Rashi, this Chazal, at face value, it means that he brought himself onto every animal. He saw that, no, this is just not meant to be, it's not for me. And then he was with Chava, he was with Eve, and he said, oh, this is the one. Now, are we going to take such a chazal literally? Many chazals we do not take literally. And that's why the Sisei Chachamim, the Vilna Gaon and the Deres Eliyahu, the Torah Tamima, the Tzedek Lederach, the Yalkut Yoshua, the Riva, they all say, of course we don't take it literally. It means that he intellectually matched himself up with the characteristics, the Tchunas HaNefesh, the attributes, and the nature of all the respective creatures. And he said, I'm matching up myself intellectually with them, and they're not for me. We're not in sync with one another. And so intellectually, he saw Chavi, he saw Eve, and he said, oh, we were meant to be. She's my soulmate, etc. But of course, Chas V'Shalom, God forbid, it doesn't connote a sense of bestiality. He didn't have relations with the animals. Of course, we can't say such a thing. In fact, the Maral writes explicitly in his Gur Aryeh commentary, he was commanded on the Arayas, on things of immorality, of Gili Arayot, he couldn't have relations with the animals. Of course, we don't take it literally. The Lavush, and others say it's something that's disgusting. The Tzedek Lederach says we wouldn't have Adam go to Banakim, the great Adam, would never lower himself to be with animals. So, of course, we don't take it literally. But there's one commentary. The Taz writes in his Divrei Dovid commentary on Rashi, there in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 23, that he might have had some physical contact with the animals. We're thinking of animals the way that we know them now. We have to realize that pre-original sin, before Adam and Eve ever partook of the tree of knowledge, just like they were in a far loftier, much more elevated spiritual plane, so too the animals of the world were also, they were much different. Chasam Sofer writes in a few places, Ramosha Sofer, that Adam and Eve were like angels before the sin, and the animals were like Adam and Eve today, post the sin. Animals were like at our spiritual level, and they were putting this planet to serve mankind. We messed up, we took ourselves down, and we took the animal kingdom and the rest of all of the universe we took down with us. But there is that one commentary that animals were actually holy. There was something special about them. But it's a one commentary going up against so many others. So of course we don't take the Chazal literally at all. It means purely that he matched himself up intellectually. They're not for me. Okay? Animals in a different plane. So we have here disputes. Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Could they eat? Could they not eat? It's a dispute. If an animal died in its own, only then could they, according to some opinions, according to everybody, you could never kill an animal for the sake of its meat. Now we get to the flood, and all of a sudden after the flood, Noah and his family, they come out of the ark. We're holding by Genesis, by chapter 9, verse 3. And Noah's issued a command, you and your family, you can partake of meat. So what changed? What changed? How do you understand that?
Noah's drunk.
Again. When he's drunk, okay, but why would he be granted now the license to eat meat? He didn't eat meat of his own accord. He ate meat because God told him now he could eat meat. So what changed? What changed from God's perspective?
They didn't have any
food.
Oh, so we don't see that they didn't have any food, but that's an excellent point. Made by the Abarbanel and by Rav Samson of Falhirsch that they have food, but just like the world suffered immeasurably, in the aftermath of the great deluge. In the aftermath, the world was inundated, water saturated the whole place. So vegetative lifestyle was not sufficient any longer to sustain mankind. And therefore, since plant and vegetative qualities have now diminished in the wake of the flood, now they needed something more. So right, the Abarbanel and Rabbi Hirsch, that's why they were given a command, now you can eat meat. The Malbim, Rameir Leibush Malbim, as well as the Tzor HaMor commentary, they say it wasn't the plant and vegetation that changed, it was actually human, the human physiological makeup, the anatomy of mankind changed. We weren't as strong. Remember the lifetimes, just the longevity that we read about before he gets to the post-flood era. People were living 900 Adam, 930 Meshulach, 969. They were living these unbelievable lives. Things change. You know what changed? Not necessarily plant and vegetation. According to the Malbim and Tzor HaMor, we changed in the aftermath of the flood. We went out of strong. What can give us the strength? We need the protein. We need the sustenance that only meat, nutritious meat, can provide. Okay? One other opinion, the Sfarno, another notable commentary. He writes in his commentary in the book of Genesis in chapter 6 and verse 13, it was actually that the climates changed. We used to have, part of utopia was, you were living in San Diego. Imagine living in San Diego when it's 75 degrees with a nice breeze blowing in your hair, right? Which, you know, of course, you know, we enjoy before, you know, we lose the hair. I had to enjoy that breeze at 75 degrees outside. San Diego weather, no hurricanes, no nothing. It's great. This is San Diego multiplied exponentially. That's gone. Everything was perfect. So society, the climate, everything stimmed. Everything was just the way it ought to be. In the aftermath of the flood, everything changed. And there was an article in U.S. News and World Report many years ago that really the Bible commentaries already talk about how the whole world changed. The world was tilted on its axis ever so slightly. And because of that, we have hurricanes and tsunamis and all this crazy stuff. It's an unbelievable discussion. You'll have to bring me back a second time now for that one. Either way, the climate changed. It's not the same anymore. And therefore, we had to eat meat to go and get the sustenance. In addition, we have the Ramban, Achamanides writes, that because the animals were only granted life, b'schus Noah, and the merit of Noah, he put them on the ark. He put them, remember, all the creatures were only on the ark. In fact, there was a great caricature in the Wall Street Journal years ago, and it showed the unicorn and all those Harry Potter creatures lined up outside a big sign on Noah's ark, and it said, stand by. They never made it home. And another great caricature, they had, you know, the dinosaurs, and one dinosaur says to the other, shucks, I thought they were leaving until tomorrow. So we had creatures who never made it on to Noah's Ark. But they only made it on to Noah's Ark because he brought them on. He knew what to bring on, and he was, oh my God, he saved their lives. You guys owe him one. You owe him big time. You have to give up some of your meat. You have to give over to Noah. That's what Ramban writes. The way it's explained by the Radak and the Meshech Chochma in their respective commentaries on Parshas Noach, chapter 9 and verse 3. It's B'schar Tipulo Behem. Because he was metapol, he involved himself. He cared. He got spat on. He was defecated on, as I'll say. He was bitten by the lion, etc. He had to work and involve himself with these animals. This is hard work. So measure for measure, he gets awarded. He's allowed to eat some of their meat afterwards. Okay, he's allowed to eat the meat. One famous comedian, not a very intelligent one, once said, he says, you know, I can't understand what he means vegetarian. If God wants us to be vegetarian, so why did he make animals out of meat? Meat's so good. That's what he said. Meat is so good. Why shouldn't we go and eat the meat? So we have all these differences. What changed pre the flood, post the flood? We have Ramban that thought they were only kept alive in the merit of Noah. We have the Ramban, as explained by the Radak and the Meshech Chochma, that as a reward for him having been involved in caring for them and showering them with love, concern, and attention, TLC, that's why he's able to go and eat some of their meat. We have the Sfarno, the environment, the climate's changed, they diminished in the wake of the flood. And we have the Abarbanel and Rabbi Hirsch, plant and vegetative no longer was sufficient sustenance for Adam and Eve, for anyone alive in the world, for mankind. And we have the Malbim and the Tzor HaMor, that we were no longer Abel, our bodies, we were weakened. We couldn't live as long. We weren't as healthy as strong. So we were able now to eat meat. So in the end of the day, post the flood era, so it seems, yes, whatever the ideal was, but now things change. And now we're 100% entitled to go ahead and eat meat. So it's great. Everybody can eat meat. Or can everybody eat meat? Right, so Rabbi Yudah Chassid, one of the greatest of the Rishonim, and his monumental work labeled the Sefer Chassidim. He discusses into places, one is in Os Shin Gimel, number 303. He says, yes, you're allowed to eat meat post the flood era, but only if what? Only if you're like Noah and you're involved in learning Torah. The Medrash tells us in Vayikra Rabbah and Parsha 2 and number 10 that Noah studied the Torah, he learned the Torah. If you learn Torah, then as a reward for learning Torah, because Torah weakens a person, study weakens a person, you're allowed to go ahead and eat meat. He writes again in tough Resh Pei Beis, number 1082. It's a long word, but don't worry, a lot of the pieces are very short. He writes in number 1082, you know why you're allowed to eat the meat of animals? Because you have to blow shofar in Rosh Hashanah. So you have to go out and kill the ram so you can get the shofar. And we have to write Sifrei Torah and Tefillin and Mezuzos. So you have to skin the hides of the animals in order to make parchment to write the Mezuzos and the Sifrei Torah. So you know what? You took away the antlers, you took away the horns in order to blow the shofar to fulfill the biblical commandment of blowing the shofar and hearing the shofar sound in Rosh Hashanah. And you have to write Sifrei Torah, Tefillin and Mezuzos. You have to skin their hides and make that out of parchment. So you know what? There's me. What are you going to do now? Baal Tashkas, Tosa, don't let things go to waste. Right? So Sefer Chassidim, once you used so much of the animal for so many different mitzvot, now you have the meat left over. I want you to go and eat the meat. That's where you can now go and eat the meat. You used it for so many mitzvot, now you can go and eat the meat. In fact, it's an interesting discussion. Can a Jew go hunting? Is a Jew allowed to go hunting?
There are laws about hunting.
There are laws about hunting. Excellent. Well, on Shabbos, of course.
Hunt.
Right, but what about not on Shabbos? Someone says, I want to go on a hunting trip.
If there are laws about hunting, so of course you're allowed to hunt.
So what are the laws about hunting? It doesn't say in the Torah. All we know in the Torah is that there's something called Shechita, and yes, the Ramban does write, in his commentary in the Torah in Genesis in 1, verse 29, that the only way, only method of killing an animal that the Torah granted us a license to do is by ritual slaughter, is by Shechita, which means that to shoot an animal, to kill an animal in any other way besides ritual slaughter, is already a violation of Tzav Alechai. We have a commandment in the Torah that's discussed in the Babylonian Talmud. Anyone? Tractate Bava Metzia 32a. It talks about Tzav Alechayim, and we opine that it's a deraisa. It's a biblical command. You're not allowed to cause unnecessary harm to animals. That's why it's a big problem with veal, right? You can't, you have to know. The slaughterhouses are treating the camps, etc. You're not allowed to cause unnecessary pain or harm to animals. And therefore, because of Tzav Alechayim, if you kill an animal any other way besides Shechita, which the Prima Gaudim is one of the foremost commentaries on the Code of Jewish Law, he writes in his introduction to the laws of Shechita, this is what the Torah determined, minimizes the animal's pain to the greatest degree, and to kill an animal in any other fashion besides Shechita, besides ritual slaughter, cutting the kona and the veshet, cutting the esophagus, etc. I can tell you, Shechita is not an easy thing. When I was in Israel, years ago, I studied the laws of Shechita. Not to be a practicing shochet, but look, you want to know everything, right? You got to know Torah. So I was studying the laws of Shechita. So we had to practice on these chickens. And I got to tell you, it's very hard because I love animals. I used to have a pet turtle. I called him Rocky. I love it, and it's very hard to shech. You know, you have all this mercy, this natural compassion. You don't want to kill the chicken, right? He's like, come on, Rabbi, you gotta kill the rat. You can't wait all night. But this is a mitzvah. And if you do it as a mitzvah, minimize the animal's pain to the extent, and even Temple Grandin talks about in her books, that Jewish ritual slaughter does minimize the animal's pain to an incredible degree. The animal dies instantly. If you pick up the blade, the knife can't have any, it has to be completely smooth, can't have any ridges whatsoever, and it has to be one slice cut. It's so many intricate laws, manifold, multifarious laws, all mandating that you minimize the animal's pain to the greatest degree. So the Ramban seems to indicate, and the Aruch Chaim HaKadosh talks about this explicitly in his commentary on Parshas Mishpatim, Yehuda Yaleh Asad has a truth about it as well, to kill an animal in any other way besides Shechita is a violation of Tzav HaLechayim, causing unnecessary pain to shoot an animal. It died instantly, but it didn't die as quickly as ritual slaughter, and therefore it's going to be forbidden. But the note of Yehuda, Rabbi Cheskel Landau, the famous, the renowned rabbi of Prague in the 1800s, he writes in his commentary, his book of responsive called Shalosh HaTshuvos, note of Yehuda, And the Madura Kamen, the first edition in Yoredeya, the section of Yoredeya, in number 10, he says that you could get out of the issue of Tzav Alechaim. If you kill the animal with a gun and you shoot it, you kill it instantly. And there are two other reasons why a Jew is not allowed to go hunting. And this is the response that's most often quoted, why a Jew is forbidden to go hunting. And not necessarily because of Tzav Alechaim. According to some commentaries, yes. The Rabbi Yecheskel Lando, the rabbi of Prague, writes, you know why? Because a Jew is not allowed to put himself or herself into a precarious situation. And we know, and I've read articles, believe it or not, most people that die in hunting accidents, it's not because they got shot. It's because they've had heart attacks or they fell out of trees. And the stress, the anxiety, it's unbelievable. I've articles on file. That's how most people die. And you know, put yourself in a dangerous situation. We know the verse tells us in Parshat Ve'et Hanan, in the book of Deuteronomy, in Sefer Devarim, in chapter 4, in verse 15, you have to go extra special out of your way and guard yourself that you're not going to be harmed. You can't put yourself in a dangerous situation. You don't want to put yourself in harm's way if it happens to come. That's one thing. You can't rely on miracles. You're not allowed to go hunting, he writes. Reason number 2, in Tract 8, and Yevamot, in the Babylonian Talmud, in 79a, the Talmud relates that every Jew is defined by three cardinal traits. Rachamonim, Baishonim, and Gomlei Chasodim. And Jews are merciful people. And Jews have shame, humiliation, and Jews are people involved in Chesed. In fact, I can't give you the source yet for this, but there's a study, and that a rabbi just related to me that he heard from a friend who works at Harvard, and there was a study recently going on in Harvard University, a secret study, and they've taken the most advanced MRI machines, magnetic resonating, etc., and they've the most advanced ones, and they've analyzed the brains of different people from different religions. When they've asked them the following question, famous psychological dilemma. What happens if you're watching a train, and a train is heading on a track where there are 6 young, beautiful children, innocent kids playing on the track. And there's a lever. And you could redirect the route of that train. But if you redirect it, there's a drunk, a guy who is known as the town drunk, and he's never sober. And he decides, I know that the train, I looked at the schedule, and I know that the train is not coming on this track for 3 hours. And he lies down to get a suntan on the nice, comfortable train tracks. And there he is on the train tracks. Now, you have a choice. The train is coming at 80 miles an hour. You're right by the lever, and it's heading towards the 6 innocent children. You can turn the lever, but that means you're actively redirecting the train onto that drunk. Or do you just let nature run its course? What would you do? And you know what? The answer is not important. What's fascinating, and this I heard from someone who had an insight, taking as a friend who works in Harvard. They've done MRIs, they've taken people from different religions. And they're astounded, and that's why they're not making this public, that the MRIs have shown that Jews, those who espouse Judaism, they grapple the parts of their brain that show that you're grappling with a dilemma, with a psychological dilemma, and there's far more activity in the Jewish brain than in any other religion's brain. And the answer is not important. And so when you hear the question, you cringe. Oh my gosh, what's going to be? Do I let the kids die? Do I kill the drunk? What's morally correct? It's not even the answer. It's that the Jew grapples with it. The Jew is troubled. It bothers you. It irks you. And that goes on in certain activities in the brains. And Jews respond. You know why? Because Jews are rachmanim. We're a merciful, compassionate people. And writes the note of Yudah Rabbi Yecheskel Landau, if you go hunting, and you know what that does? That breeds, that engenders feelings of callousness, of cruelty. I kill the animal, kill the lion. And I've been sent by certain videos. People have sent me videos, people that have gone to Africa, they shoot the lions, and you see a bad side of them come out. Shooting, let's kill. Jews were rachmanim b'shanim. So that's why they write that it's forbidden to go hunting. And we got to be nice people. We don't want to engender, we don't want to foster any feelings of cruelty, of callousness in us whatsoever. Now let's get down to business. And we discussed a certain heterum, when you can eat animals, when you can't eat animals. And the Marshal also comments on this, Rav Shlomo Lurie, he's brought by the Chidera Chaim Yosef David Azulai, the famous Sephardi Torah giant in the 1800s, who writes in the second volume of his response called Chaim Shalom, number 40, He says that you're allowed to eat meat if you're eating to give yourself sustenance. There's a certain strength when you eat meat. You can stay up longer sometimes. It gives you a certain ability to get up. It gives you the proteins. If you're eating it for the right reasons, then 100% it's Beseder Gomer. It's okay. You're allowed to go and eat the meat. Now let's get back to the VRG, the Vegetarian Resource Group. Let's go back to the National Zogby Polls. 2000-2004. And let's quickly tear apart the different reasons. If a person wants to be a vegetarian because you don't like the taste, you don't like the taste, that's fine. The Torah doesn't say you can't be vegetarian because you don't like the taste. If you don't like it, you don't like it. But what do you do when it comes Shabbos? And let's say you don't like it, or let's say you can't afford it. What do you do on Shabbos so you can't afford the meat? You buy chicken. Chicken, according to many commentators, still has a certain quasi-halachic status of basar, of meat. But what if you can't afford it? Unfortunately, today's day and age, financial crisis abounds. What if you can't afford it if you don't like the taste? We have the Babylonian Talmud telling us in tractate Shabbat in 118b and again in 119a, how you ma'anig the Shabbat? How do you bring onig, pleasure and delight, to Shabbat? And by eating basar, v'dogim, mechom atamim, you have to eat fish and you have to eat meat. Is this an obligation? Am I bound to this? No, they're just suggestions. And even though the Rambam Maimonides codifies this in his magnum opus in the Yana Chazak in Hilchot Shabbat in chapter 30, number 10, he does quote to this Gemara in Shabbat 118b, and it is brought down in the Shulchan Aruch in Hilchot Shabbat in Archaim, it's in Reish Peichet, number 288. Say, yes, but you don't have the obligation. Meaning what? If you eat meat or chicken on Shabbat, you guarantee fulfill the mitzvah, the commandment, to be ma'anik, to take pleasure and delight in Shabbat. But if you don't like meat, or you can't afford it, you can have a piece of fish. If you're a vegetarian, ad kerekach, you don't want to have fish, some don't have honey, some want to have eggs, etc. You can have a salad. And if you have a salad, if you have a pasta, lasagna, as long as this is what you're eating for the purpose of owning Shabbat, and then it's permissible. The Shulchan Aruch, again, Code of Jewish Law, and the section called Yerodeah, and number 341, and number 1, he also writes that if a person loses a relative, sometimes it's very hard to eat. Who wants to eat? You just lost a relative, Rachman al-Litzlan, and we shouldn't have to hear such bad news, and you don't want to eat meat, you're not in the mood. You're allowed to say, my onik Shabbat is to not eat. It'll give me more pleasure by not eating today than if I force myself, I compel myself to eat. Halacha l'maisa, according to the letter of the law, and there are cases, if you have a nightmare the night before, you're allowed to have what's called a tanit chalom, and you're allowed to abstain from eating altogether on Shabbat, and that's permissible. You have to be mesif tanis, you have to make up a fast for fasting on Shabbat, but there are ways around it. So on a Shabbat you can get around. And what about if you're a vegetarian, you're the one that's a simchat yom tov? We just had Sukkot, Shmini Atzeret. And here we have to deal with another Gemara. This is in the Babylonian town of Tractate Pesachim 109a, the verse in Parshat Reva, Samachta v'chagecha. And it says, Anoshim Roilam, how do you make a woman happy? You buy them jewelry and clothing. Our sages tell us, you buy the wife jewelry and clothing. If you can't afford jewelry and clothing, this is coming from the sages, by the way. It's there in the Din of the Gemara. Wives, you have to know this Gemara. If you can know any Gemara, you got to know this one. A husband is obligated to be mesameach et ishto, and he has to buy, depending on when you live, what their mashim, what they consider important, you have to buy your wife jewelry or clothing. However, what if you can't afford it? And then Rosh Shlomo Kluger writes in Hilchot Yom Tov and Archaim Tokiv Chavtes, then you can maybe get her shoes. Shoes maybe count. Based on the Gemara Ksuvos, that shoes is also called clothing. It's much cheaper. And much cheaper. I told my wife once, we went to an outlet mall. I said, go to Nine West. Go to wherever you go. Just buy 100 pairs of shoes. I'll be exempt from the next 100 years. I don't know. And so you can buy a pair of shoes and write Stayin Weiss in a Chuvah and Minchat Yitzchak. And Chelek Yud, you can also perhaps even get her flowers, or you could buy her safer, you could buy her book, as long as it's not a book for you. And you're buying another book for you. Oh, well, honey, I bought that. Oh, come on, you bought it for you. But if you buy her a book that she's going to read and she's going to use on the Chag, on the Yom Tov, and she's going to get Simcha from it, or you're going to buy her flowers, my grandfather always told me, he says, eat them before you get married. I have two pieces of advice. He says, number one, and this is the key to any happy marriage, you got to love your wife more than yesterday, but not as much as tomorrow. And that's number one. You're going to forget everything else I said tonight? You're not going to forget that line. That's for sure. Number two, you're not going to forget anything I said. You remember all the sources, everything. So number two is, you got to buy your wife flowers every Shabbat and every Yom Tov. And that's always a safe bet, because if you don't get her a dress, you don't get her an outfit, you don't get her jewelry, at least you buy her flowers, something. But there's a Torah, a biblical obligation. You have to make her happy. And you have to go on a bonus of it. That's vis-a-vis the woman. What about the men? Ain't simcha l'babasar, and miyom shachar beit hamikdash, the Gemara says, ain't simcha l'bayayim,
Okay? So here the Gemara says, it's Boshayayim, the Pischei Tshuva bought in Yardin, the code of Jewish law. And number 341, it's Sifkotan 13, brings a Chamudi Daniel, that it's a problem. If you want to be a vegetarian, it's much easier on Shabbat than Shabbat. If you want to have fish, and you want to have salad or pasta, it's much easier. Because that's not even necessarily a biblical obligation. But on Yom Tov, on the Chag, on Sukkot, on Pesach, on Shavuot, it's a biblical obligation. And the Gemara states explicitly, based on a Tosefta, you have to have meat. If you're a man, you have to meet, but really that's only in time of Beit HaMikdash. And the Rambam even codifies it in the laws of Yom Tov in chapter 6, number 16 and 17. He talks about this idea, but halacha l'maisa is a way out as well. If anyone's a vegetarian, even on Yom Tov halacha l'maisa, writes Rabbi Yosef Engel, and writes in his Gilyoni Ashas in the Gemara there, and Babylonian Talmud Shakti Pesachim 109a, writes the Shagat Aryeh Rabbi Yehuda Gizrin in the 1600s, and number 65 of his book Responsive, that it doesn't mean you have to eat meat, you have to drink wine. It means you gotta be happy. Yom Tov is, you gotta be happy. The Vilna Gaon used to say, you know the hardest mitzvah in the Torah to keep? 613. And you know the hardest one to keep? Simchat Yom Tov. You know what it's like, Sukkot? We had 8 days now. 7 plus 1, we had 8 days. How many people can honestly say they were happy all throughout the ages? Now, I know the ones who got a lot of jewelry and a lot of clothing, and had a lot of, maybe you were a little, but you have to be happy. It's one of the hardest mitzvot in the Torah to keep. You got to be happy. Simcha, the command is not to have to eat meat. The Torah's not interested. Eat meat and drink wine. The Torah says you got to be happy. It happens to be that if you're really happy and you got good meat and good wine, why wouldn't you? You have a Cabernet Sauvignon that's a $20-$30 bottle. If you're really happy, why wouldn't you want to make a l'chaim? Why wouldn't you want to make a toast? You got a great steak sitting in the freezer. Why wouldn't you want to take out the prime rib? Why, if you're really happy, why wouldn't you want to celebrate? Why don't you want to? That's why you have to eat it. Or it's a mitzvah if you eat it. Like the Drisha writes, like the Yamsha Shlomo writes, or Shlomo Leon is Yamsha Shlomo in the second parak of Be'ah number 17. Like the Miralach and Tavkav Chotes and Archaim, a lot of sources on it. It's not an obligation. I have to mean I have to drink wine. You don't have to imbibe wine. It means you got to be happy. And you know what? If learning Torah makes you happy, you can learn Torah. Rabbi Krupski wants to have shiurim. Okay, guys, any vegetarians, you can go to Rabbi Krupski's house. He's going to say Torah the whole day. He's going to say Torah. Well, let him have his children, let him have his meat first. But afterwards, it's it. Anyone's a vegetarian, you just got to be happy. So you go to one of the shiurim, and he'll say Torah all day. What makes a person happy? If you're quoting Hashem, Yisharim, something. We're not letting him learn Torah and Tishbav. You know why? Because Torah makes people happy. What's more geschmack? What's more exciting? I know people, when they come to a shiur, they say, oh, it was so sweet, I could lick it off my fingers. Click it off my fingers, right? The Torah is in the Sukkah Midvash, it's even sweeter than honey. Isaac Asimov writes in his Book of Facts, until they discovered sugar in the West Indies trade in the 11th century, everything sweet was all about honey. The land of flowing milk and honey, Eretz Zamath Flam Advash, the most sweet thing in the world was honey. There was nothing else sweet. Sugar wasn't yet discovered. So the archetype of what sweetness was the honey. Honey is the sweetest thing in the world. In fact, I wanted to suggest once, you know, Gematria, Hebrew numerical equivalents, a wife is called what? An Isha. Isha is Aleph Shin Hei. The Gematria, Aleph is 1, Shin is 300, Hei is 5, 306. And Devash is also 306. So maybe that's why husbands call their wives honey. Because honey, Isha is 306 and Devash is 306. There's nothing sweeter than honey. That's got to be the sweetness. And the Torah is even sweeter than honey. The Torah is sweeter than honey. There was a Hasidic rabbi once said, you have to treat your wife like a pair of tefillin. Pair of tefillin. Because the husband, wherever the husband goes, he always takes his tefillin with him. And he always gives it a kiss in the morning when he puts it on. And he gives it a kiss when he puts it away. And he always cradles it and he treats it with love, with care and concern. The tefillin, tefillin, tefillin! Says, if that's how you treat the tefillin, you got to treat your wife 100 times even better than the tefillin. You got to treat her with respect. You got to take her with you wherever you go. You got to give her a kiss in the morning, kiss at night. That's the tefillin. That's the sweetness. That's the Torah. That's the Isha. That's the Devash. It's all about honey. So, a person on Yom Tov, even though the Torah tells us you have to be happy, you can be happy by learning Torah. You don't have to have the meat. So a person, halacha l'maaseh, could be a vegetarian. There's a way out of the mitzvah oneg Shabbat. Whatever gives you delight, you like fish, you like pasta, lasagna, eggplant, whatever you want, take your pick. And even on Yom Tov, like the Shagas Aryeh, like Rabbi Yosef Engel and others, halacha l'maaseh, according to the Shrik letter of the law, you could be a vegetarian and you could have simcha, make sure to learn Torah, make sure to do something fun and exciting on Yom Tov, and you can fulfill the obligation, midya raisa, of simchat Yom Tov. So there are ways out of it. What's the only problem? If you can't afford it, no problem. If you don't like the taste, no problem at all. However, or health concerns. If there are actual health concerns, then you might actually be forbidden to partake of meat. If your doctor tells you you're not allowed to partake of meat, that's the Torah's command. And Parashat Vetchan in Deuteronomy, in chapter 4, and verse 9, and again verse 15, Raki Shomer Lecha Avin Hashmata L'Nashasecha, you have to guard your health. So you're not allowed to eat anything that's dangerous. That's a separate problem. The only issue with vegan vegetarian is the following. If a person says, environmental concerns, okay? You're worried about the environment? Because of that, you're allowed to be worried about the environment. But if a person questions the Torah on moral and ethical grounds, saying the Torah gives license post the flood, God told Noah, you're allowed to kill animals for the sake of the meat. Now, we saw a lot of qualifications. Not stam, you cannot let it go hunting. You have to kill them and you have to actually eat the meat. Fishing is a whole separate issue, by the way, because many people say there are no nerves and the mouth of the fish gets caught, so it's not causing them any pain whatsoever. And no problem with fishing. Fish don't require shechita, of course. You just take them out of the water and you're allowed to eat fish. It's an amazing, by the way, society. You know, like Jackie Mason used to joke, whoever ate raw fish? Raw fish, now we give it a fancy name, sushi, and everyone's running to eat it. Oh, who touched raw fish? It used to be raw fish was mufsa on Shabbos. Because nobody touched raw fish. You give it a fancy name, sushi. You dress it up, you put on a nice little dress, a nice little seaweed outfit, and the next thing you know, everyone's running away and they're charging us tenfold for it. So if a person questions the Torah and says, how could the Torah give license? The Torah doesn't allow you to make veal if the only way you can make veal is causing unnecessary pain to animals. Torah does not allow you to mishandle, to mistreat animals. That's a violation of the Torah command called Tzavar Lechayim. So if you know of a slaughterhouse that they mistreat, that they chalila, God forbid, they abuse the animals, 100% stay away. One of, not even a shadow of a doubt. But if you have a slaughterhouse that's recommended by the rabbis, and we know that they follow all the codes and all the laws and all the rules and regulations, the government's concerns, etc., for a person to say, I'm going to be a vegetarian because I don't hold to the Torah. The Torah is wrong. The Torah says, you can eat meat? No, you can't eat meat. It's disgusting. How can you? If the Torah gave us permission, if it might not be the ideal, it might not have been the ideal originally, maybe when Mashiach comes speedily in our days, we might go back to Adam and Eve pre the sin. But for Lamasa, practically speaking, the world we're in right now, if a person wants to be a vegetarian, you can be a vegetarian. But you can't question the Torah, because if you question the Torah, how could the Torah, the merciful Torah, through Ached Dachinom, its ways are pleasant, how could the Torah allow us to ritually slaughter? You know what happens? We have a Medrash in Kohelet Rabbah. With this we'll close. King Saul said, "Look, I'm going to go ahead, and I'm going to obey God's command to kill out Amalek, but I'm not going to kill the king." And because he had extra mercy, where mercy was not called for, he was a Rachaman when he should have been an Achzari, because he let Agag, the king of Amalek, we know that he had relations with his wife that night, they had a child, Haman, and the whole story of Purim came from that. Amalek, the Germans, Yimach Shemam, and all of that we have because King Saul did not get rid of Amalek entirely. Yeah, but come on, you got to be a nice guy. If you're too nice, when God tells you, this is what I allow you to do, then in the end, you know what happens? You're saying, I'm smarter than the Torah. In the end, he became an Achzari when he should have been a Rachman. And the same King Saul mistakenly killed out the whole city of Nov Yerukohana. If God says it's mutter, then it's mutter. If you don't want to do it, you don't like the taste, environment, no problem, it's Poseidon, but you can't question the Torah. As long as we never question the Torah, we accept it. Let's go back, let's enjoy our meat, let's not enjoy our meat. The main thing is what? That we should be besimcha, we should be besimcha tamid, we should come out every Sunday night, and we should come out with our families, because nothing unites a family better than what? Having a nice outing, having a nice dinner together, coming to learn Torah, coming to hear the sweetness, to lick the honey of Torah off your fingers, because it's the one thing in the world that's sweeter than honey. Your wife and the Torah, that's it. Those are the sweetest things in the world. We should be zochet to shalom bayis, to shalom and all bnei Yisrael. It's been a pleasure. I'm looking forward to Mitzvah Hashem to the next time. Have an amazing week. Take the simchat Torah and take it with you for the rest of the year, for the rest of your lives. And we'll meet the Mitzvah Hashem next simchat Torah on the streets of Yerushalayim or HaKodesh with the coming of the Messiah. Speed in our days. Have an amazing night and an awesome rest of the week.
Thank you very much.